Hello, welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a theoretical physicist, a cosmologist, an academic, a commentator and public intellectual. His research focuses on the beginning and end of the universe, connecting the most exciting things happening at the forefront of science to popular culture. He's also an actor, sometimes. He's been nominated for a Grammy, and of course he's an author, which is why he's here. Lawrence Krauss, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. I sound more interesting than I am, I'm sure.
Well, you know what? There's so much more that I could have put into that. It's really, really difficult to hone it down to what and who you are. So I'm so pleased that we've got half an hour together.
A whole half an hour to spend. Okay.
to explore all of that. Let's start with your interest in science. Where did that come from?
Well, actually, first it probably happened because my mother wanted me to be a doctor, and she made the mistake of telling me doctors were scientists. And then I learned that doctors weren't scientists, but then it was too late. She was heartbroken. But I really got interested in science by reading books by scientists, by people like Einstein and George Gamow and Richard Feynman. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why I write, actually, is to return that favor. And when it happens, as has happened, because I've been writing for a long time, that someone tells me, who's now a scientist, that reading books by me when they were kids turned them onto science. That's just the greatest favor. I mean, it's wonderful to hear that. So I think it was their excitement about the world. And really, I think what the key thing that I most remember was reading a book by Richard Feynman when I was in high school. I was on some course for good science students in the summer, and the teacher saw I was bored, so he gave me this book. And it was only then that I realized that it wasn't all done. That it wasn't all done 200 years ago by dead white men, and that really there were so many mysteries yet to be solved, and that was too tantalizing not to be involved with. And I really thought, and the reason I got involved with theoretical physics, I think, is because it was sexy, is because it was the really, I found those questions, the fundamental questions of being potentially the first person to understand how the universe worked in a certain way, to be unbelievably attractive. And why would you not want to be working on that?
So how did you take it forward?
Well, like most things in my life, I didn't have a real plan. I'm still not sure I do. I knew I liked physics, and so I did that, but I liked history, I liked people, and I found physics, unfortunately, at the realms that I wanted to do it, incredibly removed from the human experience, and it was hard to juggle those things. So I worked on a history book, I took time off school. But I eventually did my PhD in physics. I did a mathematics degree and a physics degree. But I never thought I'd get a job because at that time, and there's still not many jobs, I didn't have the expectation of getting a job. I almost actually came to England because there was a Rhodes, potential to do a Rhodes Scholarship. And I'm very happy I didn't, because I was going to come to England and do physics and philosophy, which I think is a huge mistake, because I think I went to the United States to just do physics, because philosophy is, again, very attractive. The philosophical questions are deep and interesting. But when it comes to making progress in physics, and I've said this and people think it's a detraction or somehow about philosophy, it's not really, but philosophy is not relevant. It's not useful to doing physics at the forefront. That doesn't mean it's not a useful discipline. But physics is the questions, the areas of science which are so well-defined as physics, philosophy doesn't have an impact. In areas where science isn't well-defined and philosophy can help you develop critical questions like consciousness, how the brain works, those things are interesting. But physics, it's done by physicists. And the physicists can't even spell philosophy.
So your academic career took off and you began
I was lucky
writing.
Enough to get a job. I mean, yeah, I did my PhD at MIT and I learned how to juggle and I figured I'd drive a taxi or something like that. But I was fortunate. I got a job at Harvard after that and it was sort of took off eventually.
Now, you're still attached to a university. And yeah. One of the things that you do there is the Origins Project. What's that?
It's like being a kid in a candy shop. I moved to Arizona to do that. Arizona State University literally is the most entrepreneurial university I know of. And I was basically said, you want to do this? It's interesting. Do it. And we look at questions from the origins of the universe to the origins of consciousness and violence, basically every interesting question you can ask. If you think about it, the forefront of almost all scholarly questions, the forefront areas have to do with origins. And so it's a wonderful rubric. It's a way of unifying all of these areas. And we look at those most exciting questions. We bring the best people in the world together at ASU for a weekend workshop. And the big buzzword in Arizona is transdisciplinary. Namely, we try and bring people together from lots of different fields who might not normally talk to one another. For instance, we just had a workshop on the future of artificial intelligence and basically the potential threats of artificial intelligence. But one of the things that just amazed me is we brought together people who work on AI, but we also brought together people from the intelligence community, and by that I mean the defense communities, and they never really talked to one another, many of them. And there was obviously a huge issue given cyber terrorism and that sort of thing. And it's happened many times. We did a workshop on the origins of life, and we brought together biologists, but chemists and geophysicists and astrobiologists. And again, different people had very different perspectives on that. And one of the things that's important, because I'm interested in the public understanding of science, we don't just do those workshops. When we do the workshops and they lay the basis for future research, we always have a public event associated with it. And our public events have 3,000 people attending. 3,000 people pay because they're interesting. And then maybe sometimes 500,000 people watch online. And I find that amazingly gratifying because these are questions that people should be interested in. Synthetic biology. We've had workshops on climate change, on violence, on actually sexuality and gender in the 21st century. So the questions are relevant to inform the public. And mm-hmm. So I love that balance that we create in the Origins Project. So for me, it's just wonderful because I can think of the most interesting questions we can think about, and I get to invite the most interesting people in the world and spend time with them.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And of course, throughout this, you've been writing books. Your first book, 1989, The Fifth Essence, The Search for Dark Matter in the Universe, as is apparent from the title about dark matter.
Yeah.
Fear of Physics, A Guide for the Perplexed. Now, that's for people like me who are just really frightened of science.
Yeah, I think many people are frightened of science, probably because of your science teachers in school, I think. Because, you know, we're all born. It's not as if people are born frightened of science. All kids are born scientists. And it's really the questioning, the fun, the playfulness, the questions about the world. And when little babies are put their hands in a fire and get burned, I mean, it's science and something. But we somehow make it intimidating and make it seem like only certain people can do it and that it's disconnected from the rest of the world. And so Fear of Physics, of course, was a play on the title of Fear of Flying. But what I tried to show there is that the tools that scientists can understand the world very effectively because of a certain set of tools that we use. And those tools are useful for people to think about. And I thought I could explain it. It was a fun book. And unlike my first book, which probably sold 5 or 6 copies, I'm amazed I actually wrote a second book because I suppose if this is about writers, maybe writers might be listening or future writers might be listening. But it can be very discouraging. I think a lot of people want to write. And I think the ultimate reason, the only reason to write is because you want to. Mm. It's like anything. I'm a scientist because I enjoy it, not necessarily to change the world. But but you just have to do it because you enjoy it. And given publishing as it is, it's amazing to me any book actually ever gets produced and sells. So I'm happy in retrospect that I persevered and wrote a second book and then others after that.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's very anecdotal. It's very accessible, as is from that point on all of your work. And in fact, the next one, even the title, shows your kind of fascination with popular culture and the way that you try and bring the two together. It's The Physics of Star Trek.
Yeah, no, that book began as a joke, actually, because my editor and I were talking about what my next book would be, and her daughter was a Trekker, and she said, "What about the physics Star Trek?" We were talking, and then I thought it was ridiculous. And then I taught at Yale at the time. I was taking the train back from New York, and I started to think, well, you know, how would I make a transporter? And then I started to think all the neat kind of physics questions. Oh, this would be a fun way to introduce physics, but it was incredibly intimidating. When I signed the contract to do that book, I realized I could be alienating 20 million Star Trek fans in the States alone. And the problem was how to write such a book because, I mean, a book that says this won't work, that won't work, that won't work wouldn't be very much fun. And yet I firmly believe I have very few standards, perhaps. One of them is not to knowingly mislead. And so because I'm a scientist, I could say that inside protons were little pink elephants and some people would believe me. And so it's really important to try to not knowingly mislead. And so if something is impossible, you got to say it's impossible, even though people would like it to be true. So how to do that? And the idea that I hit on eventually was to, if something in Star Trek was impossible, okay, to say that. But then there are often things in the real world that are related, that are interesting. So to use that as a hook to jump into something in the real world that's interesting. So, and that seemed to work. And it was a lot of, in the end, that and the fact that I actually had to spend between midnight and 5 for 4 months watching every episode of Star Trek, which I hadn't planned to do. It's just I had to become an expert in Star Trek as well as the science and to be credible in that regard. And it was fun in a way. It was daunting. But it was all. It also opened a lot of doors, and it was a lot of. In retrospect, it was an obvious thing to do, but in advance, it wasn't so clear.
Well, of course, what it did do was earn you really great recognition all over the world, and I think you are recognized in many, many places. And in fact, whenever you speak, because you now have this label, public intellectual, people turn up in their thousands.
I'm humbled and amazed. It's true that there are large audiences, and some of it, I don't take it personally in the sense that I think people are really fascinated by the science. And that the hope of getting something from the horse's mouth, as my editor used to say, but also reasonably accessible. And I think that I used to work in a science museum when I was a kid, which I think was for me a very useful training. It was like vaudeville in a sense. I used to do 10 shows a day and to learning how to not only how to explain science, but what people might be interested in, because that's the key part. Is to get people hooked. As I think I was saying to you before the program, I think writing and teaching is seduction in some sense because you've really got to go to where people are. You can't expect them to be interested in what you're saying. And so I think the fact that I've been able to touch onto some of those things is some of the reasons that people have responded. And also, I frankly think partly it's because I'm interested in issues that are relevant beyond science, the relationship between science and religion, which, of course, is a big one, and between science and politics. Mm. And so I think a lot of people come because they know of me from that as well.
You don't just call yourself an atheist. You call yourself an anti-theist.
Well, I used to call myself an anti-theist because my friend Christopher Hitchens, my late friend Christopher Hitchens, used to use that term. I can't say there isn't a God. Definitively, but I can definitively say I wouldn't want to live in a universe with one. But now I've changed, I've evolved, and I'm now an apatheist. And because really, the problem with science and God is that people think it's important, and it isn't. There's all these people who spend a lot of money trying to convince people that these issues of science and cosmology and the existence of God are vital and important, and they're not. I've been a physicist for almost 40 years, and I've never been at a scientific meeting once when the word God has come up. Because as my friend Steven Weinberg, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist and also an atheist, has said, most scientists don't think enough about God to even know if they're atheists. Because it's just irrelevant. To understand the world, God is irrelevant.
Another person who's very well known in that world is Richard Dawkins. Yeah. And I know that you and he have been the subject of a film, Rockstar Scientists, really. Well, tell me about that.
Well, it's a film called The Unbelievers, and these two young guys who I met because actually they were at one of our lectures where there was huge crowds, and I got to know them. And they wanted to write, as they said, a rock and roll tour film about science to show, first of all, that scientists actually do reach people, and to say also, to some extent, what it's like to be, quote unquote, a celebrity scientist in the sense of reaching out to people. And it's a fun film, but it's also a film that I have found remarkably useful because there are large crowds and we talk about the issues of science and religion and people have written to me or come up to me around the world and said that film affected them because they realized that they were not bad people and they weren't alone for asking these questions. So I've become more interested in film in that way as well. Writing reaches a certain audience, but with film you can reach a different audience. And I think the idea, once again, is to get people to think and feel good about thinking and asking questions. And so I'm very happy. It was, in a sense, of course, it's always self-indulgent to be involved in a film about you, about oneself. But there was utility in that. It's also, I think, entertaining. So I think they did a good job.
Well, of course, you've done other films. I know that you worked with Johnny Depp.
Well, Johnny Depp is a friend of mine, and we haven't yet made a film together. I made a film with another friend of mine, Werner Herzog. I made two films with him. One was I've done documentaries with him, but then I'm happy to say that he for some reason decided he's always said he wanted me to be a villain in one of his films, and if I were going to act, I always wanted to be a villain, and indeed, in a recent movie of his, I'm a villain.
That's fantastic. You've also won a Grammy. How does that come in? Are you musical too?
No, I'm not musical at all. It just sounds good. No, the Grammy was the Grammy nomination for writing the liner notes from the music from Star Trek. After the physics Star Trek, I got asked to write the liner notes. You know what? I have to explain that because I've discovered that young people don't know what liner notes are because we used to have albums, these things called record albums, and in there would be you'd take that out and there'd be this whole sheet with all this information. And they still have CDs that have them. But since most kids now get their music digitally, they don't get the benefit of having all the written material that accompanies it. So I wrote that, but it certainly makes me seem more well-rounded than I probably am.
Tell me about the Doomsday Clock.
Okay, well, I'm fortunate enough to be the chairman of the board of sponsors of something called the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which I knew about growing up as a young physicist and student. The Bulletin was created by the scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project, a number of them, particularly, but Albert Einstein and Robert Oppenheimer were involved in starting this board of sponsors of the Bulletin. The Bulletin was designed to expose people to the dangers of nuclear war, to try and end those dangers, to explain what those they were, and to encourage the public to respond appropriately. And it was right after the First World War in 1947, it was created. And every year, every 2 years, but it depends on now we do it every year, we re-examine and have something called the Doomsday Clock, which looks at the existential threats facing humanity. It used to be just nuclear war, but in 10 years since I've been involved, we've extended it to include climate change, emerging technologies, anything that potentially can threaten civilization, and assess, as difficult as it might be, where we are. And the clock has moved from as far away as 17 minutes to midnight to as close as 2 minutes to midnight. And just this year, we moved it from 3 minutes to 2.5 minutes to midnight. So it's the second closest it's ever been to quote-unquote doomsday. Now, I would say the absolute value isn't as important as the direction. We moved it forward because the world is getting to be a more dangerous place. And every year when we announce it around the world, it's covered. And I think it's important for a moment to step back, because we all get caught up in the minutiae of news every day. But these grand questions need to be at least addressed. And it's kind of depressing. Every year we have a doomsday symposium where we bring people in and at the Bulletin and try and find out what the dangers are and then try and make a reasonable assessment. But I think it has utility. A lot of people find the clock in some ways hokey because of the image, but it's an iconoclastic image that people capture, and it does raise people's awareness. And in that sense, I think it's really important.
Now, I know that you've also advised Barack Obama.
Well, before he was president, I was on his science policy committee. And one of the reasons it was clear he was a great candidate was because he tried to bring experts from a wide variety of areas to advise him on different areas during the campaign. That's the sign of what I think is a good leader. It's the very opposite of the current leader of the United States, Donald Trump, who doesn't listen to anyone. And you can't expect a politician to be an expert at something, but they should try and get the advice from the best people they can find. So I was happy to be involved. Actually, before that, I was one of the people who started something called Science Debate 2008. We tried to get a debate between the presidential candidates on issues of science and technology, the issues that really matter, because all of the major issues facing us in the 21st century, from security to the climate to energy, all have a scientific basis. We created this group that tried to make this debate. We got the candidates to write, answer a series of questions, which were seen by about a billion different people over the time. But once that was done, then I could become partisan and I could join the candidate who I really thought at the time was the best candidate for president. But I'm happy in a way. Since that time, I haven't been in Washington in any official capacity. And I think that I can play a better role anyway. It's not as if I've been asked to be a major advisor. But even if I were, I think stepping back and being able to be critical of whoever is in government and being able to try and encourage those things and use my voice for that is probably more useful than being constrained to be within the confines of the political arena, where you really can't say what you mean.
Mm. And of course, you do say what you mean, and you say it in an engaging and very accessible way in all of your books. So I want to focus now on the last couple of books. So A Universe from Nothing was the one before your current book, which is really, where does the universe come from?
Well, it was more than that, and it had a remarkably big impact. I was kind of pleased, of course, but surprised. But it addressed that question that religion usurped, which is, why is there something rather than nothing? And the amazing thing is, by talking about the profound developments in cosmology over the last 50 years, we're able to address questions that I never thought we would address even a decade ago, but certainly when I was a student. And what's amazing is that we have this universe of 100 billion stars in our galaxy and 100 billion galaxies. So 100 billion galaxies, each containing 100 billion stars, all this stuff. And people say, well, someone must have created that stuff. But the amazing thing is that without any supernatural shenanigans, you can show how you can get all of that, 100 billion galaxies, each containing 100 billion stars, from absolutely nothing, just given the laws of physics. It doesn't violate anything. It's the ultimate free lunch. Now, we can't prove that that's the case, but I could show that it was plausible. And in that sense, my friend Richard Dawkins actually wrote the afterword to that book, but I think it carries on without seeing me as pretentious as it's going to sound. What Darwin did was demonstrate that the diversity of life wasn't designed, that you could get this incredibly amazing diversity of life from simple beginnings by natural selection. He didn't know about DNA or genes, but it was plausible. Now we're in a similar situation in cosmology where I can show, using plausibility, even though we don't have a theory of quantum gravity, that we can create everything from nothing without God. And I think that's an amazing realization. So it was a book about the revolutions in cosmology, but I think part of the reason it had such a big impact is it touched on that religious issue. Mm. And people often, it amazes me in my books, including the new one, you know, say, well, you know, how dare you touch on religion? There's very little actual writing in the book about God, but you just mention the word once and people pick up on it and suddenly jump on it.
Well, of course, and that whole theme is carried through into your latest book, The Greatest Story Ever Told. And indeed, that is how the Bible has been referred to often. Why are we here?
But there's a better, it's not that the whole title is The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Mm-hmm. And that's the important part. And because our story, the real story of the real universe, changes. And tomorrow it'll be different than today. And that's what makes it great. Because the universe keeps surprising us. It's a story, in this case, it extends from, my last book talked about the revolutions in cosmology, understanding the universe on the larger scales. This book is about our understanding the revolutions in our understanding the universe on the small scales. What are the fundamental forces that govern nature? And it goes all the way from, you know, literally Plato to the Higgs boson and beyond. But this incredible, what I think is the best example of humanity, our ability to sort of go and explore and reveal this illusion. The world we see is literally an illusion. At a fundamental scale, it's incredibly different. And it's amazing that we've been able to discover that, not just propose it, but actually experimentally discover it by building the most complicated machine humans have ever built. It's an incredible saga, and I do think it's the greatest story. But the so far part, it seems to me, is the best part, because that story keeps changing, and it will be better if some young people read it and become and get inspired to be scientists and change the story.
And of course, along the way, you tell us some wonderful stories about some of the great scientists.
Yeah, many of the scientists are interesting people. And of course, I talk about Maxwell and Faraday and the great British scientists, and then Einstein and Feynman and others. But it's not all about the people you've heard of. What's really amazing to me, and one of the reasons the story is so interesting, is that there's a secret I'll reveal to you here now. Scientists are human. And the scientists, therefore, have prejudices and biases, and they're pig-headed. And often you see them going in the wrong direction. But the great thing about science is that the scientific process can drag them, kicking and screaming, away from those blind alleys into the right direction. And you see it in the book. And I tried to go into that in detail, how the scientists, you often want to strangle them or at least shake them and say, look, the answer's right here. You have it. Why don't you go there? But it would take 20 years to get there because the scientists themselves were sort of fixated by their a priori prejudices. And the wonderful thing about science, ultimately, is it forces us to force our beliefs to conform to the evidence of reality instead of the other way around.
Mm. There's just a wonderful line, some wonderful sentences and some beautiful, beautiful writing in this. When you're talking about religion, you say, it's unfortunate that replacing ancient beliefs with modern scientific enlightenment is often described as a loss of faith. How much greater is the story our children will be able to tell than the story we have told? Surely that's the greatest contribution of science to civilization, to ensure that the greatest books are not those of the past, but those of the future.
You know, it's even those words, loss of faith, as if losing faith is somehow remove something. But in fact, it's exactly the opposite of what you gain. And I think the great thing about science in some sense is that it doesn't need any books in principle, because if you're good enough, you could discover it all yourself. And the more we learn, the simpler in some sense our vision of reality becomes. But it's always that hope. It's always that hope of what's going to come next and that a willingness to be surprised. I like to say that every day I wake up and I'm surprised if I'm not surprised, because the imagination of nature is greater than the imagination of humans. If you lock theoretical physicists in a room and ask them to come up with theories in over 50 years, whatever they came up with would have no resemblance to the real world. It's because the real world keeps prodding us and throwing us red herrings, throwing us new things that screw up the works, that force our minds to expand. when I wrote A Universe from Nothing, some people got mad because they said, well, you're really redefining what you mean by nothing. And in a sense, we are. But you know what we call that? Learning.
Your themes are, of course, the beginning of the universe, but also the end. How will it end?
Badly. At least it looks like it will. You know, the future is miserable. In fact, in The Universe of Nothing, I talked about what is the most likely future of the universe, which is that it's going to become cold, dark, and empty. All the galaxies we now see are moving away from us ever faster over time, which is a huge surprise. The expansion doesn't appear to be slowing down. It appears to be speeding up. And if you work that out in a while, 2 trillion years, all the galaxies we now see will have disappeared and the universe will become cold, dark, empty. In the far future, scientists, there'll still be stars around in our galaxy and civilizations that may develop. And those people will look out and think they live in the universe that we thought we lived in 100 years ago with a single galaxy surrounded by empty space. And then the new book I show, it could even be worse than that because we're here because of this accident of nature, that this field, invisible field, exists everywhere in the universe because this field, this Higgs field, froze near the beginning of time in a certain way, as arbitrarily perhaps as an icicle on a window freezing in a certain direction. That's why our existence is a cosmic accident. But what's equally interesting is that field might melt. And if the Higgs field melts, disappears, then everything we see in the universe, all the stars, galaxies, planets, aliens, people, everything, will disappear because the particles that make us up will suddenly become masses. So if that happens, and it's not likely, just so your listeners don't jump out the window or sell their diamonds or anything, but even if it were to happen, it wouldn't happen in a year or a million years or a billion years or a billion billion years. But given what we measured with the Higgs field, it's precariously close to being unstable. It could be stable, but if it were going to be unstable, it might decay in a long time. But if it did decay, then literally everything we see would disappear. And that reinforces for me one of the other aspects that is important for us humans in our myopic view of ourselves to realize that we tend to think that we're the culmination of the universe. The universe evolved and now it's in this great state. But it's a moment. It's a brief moment in a cosmic eternity. And in the future, it won't be like it was now.
So what does 2.5 minutes mean? How long is 2.5 minutes?
With the doomsday clock? Well, it depends. It's an eternity if you're sitting on a hot stove, as Einstein used to say, or not enough time if you're talking to a pleasant person. But 2.5 minutes means we'd better wake up as a civilization and realize there are real problems we need to deal. And humanity, for the first time in history, can globally change the planet, as well as getting rid of ourselves, as well as destroying human civilization. We are globally affecting the planet. And as Einstein said, actually, after the A-bomb went off, he said, everything has changed, save the way we think. And what we need to do is change the way we think. And it's high time.
And I think that your book can absolutely do that. The greatest story ever told so far. Why are we here? It's by Lawrence M. Krauss, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Lawrence, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to production team of George McDonough and Audrey Fyodorenko. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.